conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR 96.3, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. Well, one in three women will be victims of some form of domestic violence in their lifetimes. One in four men will have a similar experience. The statistics are sobering. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and with that in mind, tonight we hope to do just that, bring some awareness to why some abuse, how to recognize an abuser, and how to move forward if you have been a victim of domestic abuse. That and more, just part of our conversation tonight. The phone lines are open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you have a story to tell, experiences, some insight, we'd like you to be part of this conversation. Joining us tonight is Dr. Denise McCam. She's the director of Prince George's County's Family Justice Center. And Alicia Walker, she's a domestic violence advocate. Again, phone lines are open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. McCain and Ms. Walker, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
Dr. McCain, I'm going to start with you. Every year, we tend to learn something new from survivors and experts concerning domestic violence. What's the takeaway from this year's message?
Well, again, thank you so much for having me. And as you pointed out, this is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And, you know, this is a time when we bring this issue to the forefront and we advocate for change. And when I talk about change, it's change around how do we actually see domestic violence. You know, it's no longer what it used to be, something that happened behind closed doors, a private family issue that no one wanted to talk about. Not only that, but who is the victim? We also understand there's a lot more awareness around the fact that it could be anyone. Domestic violence knows no boundaries. So this year, you know, what we've really done and what we're finding around the community is that, you know, we're looking at how are we responding to this issue. You know, we recognize, and I can tell you from within the Family Justice Center, we're seeing many more cases that are much more lethal. Survivors are coming in ranking very high on our lethality risk assessment, which is a screening tool that we use just to help people understand how serious the issue is and or how much danger they're potentially in. But also recognizing that we have to be more proactive and we have to be more preventative and start looking at this issue at much younger ages. Children, middle school, are in abusive relationships, and sadly, they don't even realize that what they're experiencing is a form of abuse. It starts very early. And so we're really just hoping that this year, as we've seen around the community, much more attention has been focused on it. I'm hoping we can continue to do that, but again, with a different focus, looking at our younger children and helping them to prevent them, I should say, from getting into these relationships.
Alicia, you are a domestic violence advocate, but you're also a survivor of a abusive relationship. We talked about some of the statistics at the top, and one of those that I didn't mention is pretty much on average, it says it takes about, you know, a victim experiencing some form of abuse about seven times before they finally sort of break free and walk away from that type of relationship. What was it that made your last time and for you to walk away from your situation?
I had to pivot in the toxic relationship because it was toxic from the beginning, to actually be honest. Mm-hmm. And as our experts stated, it happened early on in my life. I had a high tolerance for toxicity because I grew up in a toxic household. So my measuring stick was as long as he didn't put his hands on me.
Mm-hmm.
So I that situation actually occurred in mine. And I knew that I did not want to have to explain or have it become a part of my child's life experience. Like, that was not something that I wanted for him because I knew what it had, the detriment it had caused me. So that was my pivot point. And then the illumination of healing began when I had the conversation with my father, and he was so upset that my my partner had done something to me, and I explained to my dad in that moment, sir, you, my mother was someone's daughter, and yet you did it to her.
Hmm.
So that was like an aha awakening for every party involved.
What was his response?
The healing process.
What was your dad's response, Alicia?
He was stunned because, of course, he called me and he was so upset and he was calling as the protector. But when I held that mirror up to him, it was just silence for a very long time on the call. But I was truly prepared that day that I was no longer going to carry the sins of my father and pass on the torch of trauma to my son. So whatever was going to have to take place in that moment would have to take place so that we all could walk away with our own stuff, if you will, and begin to work on it.
Dr. McCain, how prevalent is that, that those who've experienced domestic abuse have come from that situation as in their home as a child, seeing that, whether it's the father abusing the mother or vice versa?
Well, unfortunately, it's very common. And what we know and what research tells us is that many people who are involved in abusive relationships, whether as the perpetrator or the victim, they have witnessed the abuse in their homes. So it's almost what we call very passive. It's a passive learning process. You know, I don't think any parent or adult would say to their child, you know, when you grow up, when you get in a relationship, this is how I want you to treat your partner. They don't have to say anything. Just by watching the way two adults interact with one another, the way they communicate, the way they handle conflict, they are actually teaching that child that this is the way you relate to people when you're in relationships. So it is very, very common, and it's unfortunately one of the main causes of abuse. We know that it's learned behavior.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and tonight that is our focus. Dr. McCain, Alicia had mentioned speaking to her father, and you mentioned about parents, you know, talking to children. And very often we talk about abuse men to women, but we do know that men sometimes are abused, and that number is 1 in 4 in terms of men will experience some form of that. We can see ourselves, especially as fathers or even mothers, talking to our daughters about, you know, listen, do not let a man put his hands on you or speak to you a certain way. How often do we talk to our daughters about this is what you should not do in terms of putting your hands on a man or abusing a male? Is that prevalent, or is that something that we talk about enough?
I don't think we do. And, you know, you're right. We definitely give our daughters that lecture. You know, if anyone puts their hands on you, you know, you leave, you walk away. But we don't, unfortunately, share that same message or express that sentiment to our daughters. And as you pointed out, you stated 1 in 4 men are now reported as victims of abuse. And just remember that most people never even report their abuse, only maybe 25%. So I say that to say that number is even higher. But years ago, I remember being in this field for such a long time, that number was 1 in 7. So when we're now down to 1 in 4, it just shows you that it has become much more of a common occurrence. And yes, we should talk to our daughters. We should tell them, because we know that men are victims. And the sad thing is that men have even more challenges speaking out about it. There's already a great deal of shame and embarrassment for anyone who's in an abusive relationship. But just imagine being a man now having to reveal that you're being abused by a woman. So it is very, very difficult, but unfortunately it is much more prevalent. And I agree, we should do a better job at sharing that message with our daughters to make sure that everyone is safe. We're talking about healthy relationships, and healthy relationships are mutually respectful and do not include violence or being disrespectful to anyone, whether it be male or female.
Alicia, in your experience, were there signs very early on that you ignored? I think you sort of alluded to that you kind of saw things, but because of the situation that you came from, you didn't really press it. But were there clear signs that you can look back now and say they were there? Or was it sort of an ideal situation where he put his best foot forward and these things didn't really come up until further in your relationship?
To be quite honest, it was signs from day one. Hmm. And that's why the conversation with my dad was so important, because I had built up a high tolerance of it. So it was just like normal. And I think back even in my early childhood when I would have a little guys at school, in elementary school, that liked me, you know, they say if that boy hits you, mm-hmm. that means that they really like you. Those things are social norms that we tell kids that should not even be encouraged, because those are seeds that are sown early on. So when guys are not very kind to you, those are the ones that you pursue and stuff like that. So it was those little seeds that just grew and grew and grew and grew until I found myself in the relationship that really was the awakening, if you would, for a healing that was much needed and a confrontation, actually, because at the end of the day, our parents, our fathers for daughters, are your first, that's your first love. You know, you get that protection. That's the baseline for your relationships, if you will, with the opposite sex. And so when you're witnessing somebody that you love and adore be volatile to your mom in that space, it's just like it's a lot of confusion there. And so I had to filter through a lot to get to the other side of it, but it was early on in the relationship. I saw complete signs. I mean, hindsight's 20/20, to say the least, with magnifying glasses, you know. But the true, I guess, the core problem was not the relationship, although those were manifestations from traumas on both of our sides, me and my partner. But the core issue for me when I analyzed, because my partner did his work too, is we were co-parents, so we had to both do our work so that we could raise a heel, whole, and complete male child for this world. So we had to do our work because neither of us wanted a damaged child because of our misfortune.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's go to the phone lines. And Elaine is calling from Maryland. Elaine, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Hi. I wanted to share what happened with me. I married in the late age, 37. My grandparents raised me. So I wanted a family, a relationship, a marriage, you know, like my grandmother had, you know, with a family. So we started dating this older guy. He's 20 years older than me. And my grandmother said, oh, he's perfect. He's just like, and he seemed to be nice. I never seen no signs, nothing. And I didn't know what to look for. Okay, so after my grandparents died, he started changing. I owned my own home at that point with my grandparents. He wanted his name on the house. I did that. I thought that's what you're supposed to do. Okay. So then after he started drinking a lot, but I never smelt it on him. Okay. So afterward, let's do a fast forward. I was at home washing clothes, and he came through the door and pinned me down with a butcher knife and said, B.I.T., I ought to kill you.
So he turned violent. He wanted to own part of your property, right? And so did you end up breaking off the relationship, Elaine?
I ended up when he took that butcher knife to my throat. My kids, I had three small kids at the time, and they heard me struggling downstairs, and they called the police.
Okay.
And
well, let me. That's when you made your move. Well, thank you so much, Elaine, and I'm glad that you were able to get out of that situation. Alicia, as a domestic violence advocate, does Elaine's story sound familiar? Not necessarily about your experience, but what you hear from other domestic violence survivors.
Yeah, absolutely. Too often, you know, in the relationships sometimes there are no signs ahead of time. So you are in this relationship and all of a sudden then a stranger comes in. Your partner changes on you and you're taken off guard. So you're trying to catch up to who this person is today and you kind of reminisce on how great things were before and you're trying to walk on eggshells to get it back to that place. So you stay longer dealing in that particular situation. And so something to that extreme happens. Unfortunately for her, she was able to get out.
And Dr. McKay,
you know, I'm sorry.
You go right ahead. Mm-hmm.
I just think it's interesting also, if you listen to what she said, she started out by talking about the fact that she wanted a relationship
right.
like her grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
So she was already looking for something mm-hmm. and perhaps not paying attention to some of the signs that were there because of her predetermined desire to be in a relationship that she thought would give her something. So that is very common that women, more often than men, we know both, but I'm generally speaking about the majority, which are women, they don't pay attention to the signs because they have a goal in mind. They want a man. They want to get married. And those red flags are there, but they're just not paying attention to it because they have another agenda. So I think that's probably one of the things that, you know, had she been aware or people in general understand what's really going on, what is the motivation for being in a relationship, even if it's toxic, even if it doesn't feel right, they still find themselves there. There are lots of reasons behind it, but it generally starts with not paying attention to the signs because you have another goal in mind.
And Dr. McCain, before we go to break, what are some of those signs? What are some of the red flags? Are there some that are pretty consistent that if you see this, you should know? You know, obviously, if someone puts a knife to your neck, like Elaine was saying, that's a pretty easy sign.
Absolutely. But I mean, generally speaking, domestic violence is about power and control.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime that someone is trying to control where you go, what you do, your activities, your friends, they try to isolate you. If they're possessive, if they don't want you to be around anyone other than them, if they tell you that other people are not good for you, again, these are all manipulative tools that are used to get a person to be with them. I think, as Alicia pointed out, in the beginning, they're generally very charming, almost too good to be true. And very slowly, once they get you in their grips and they have you and you're now in love with them, you now believe that they're a person that they wanted you to see, they start slowly changing. You know, there are lots of signs. You know, again, the key to it, though, realistically for me, is anytime someone, if you don't feel right, if something doesn't feel right, if someone is not making you feel whole, healthy, respected, that should be a red flag. Something is wrong. And if it's wrong, if it feels wrong, more than likely it is wrong. And that is an indicator that you need to really pay close attention to what's going on.
Dr. McCain, before we jump over to the other side, I want to make sure our listeners have any information that you can provide, hotlines or numbers or websites that folks who may be experiencing domestic violence can call or go to and reach out for help.
Absolutely. Well, of course, I'm going to start out with the Family Justice Center, which is an initiative of the Circuit Court in Prince George's County. Our main number is 301-780-8008. We're also available on the web, which is PGC, familyjusticecenter.org. There's also, of course, the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which is 800-799-SAFE. And they'll be able to give you resources no matter where you are in the country.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, but don't forget you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on WHUR.com, or you can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. If you're on the phone, stay right there, and we're going to get to you. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. The original Quiet Storm with John Mons is next on 96.3 WHUR. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on SiriusXM channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and tonight we are focusing on that and measures for to help folks recognize if they're in a abusive relationship, the signs of that, and to move on from those relationships sooner than later, and what they look like, and even more. So our guest tonight to help us in this conversation is Alicia Walker. She's a domestic violence advocate and a domestic violence survivor. And Dr. Denise McCain, she's the director of the Family Justice Center in Prince George's County. Again, phone lines are open. If you have a story to share, some comments, some questions, we'd like to hear from you. This is your opportunity to give us a call, 202-319-7810. Let's go back to the phone lines, and Ann is calling from the nation's capital. Go right ahead, Ann, with your question or comment. You may have to turn your radio down, Ann. I think that's some feedback. Okay, we lost you, Ann. Give us a call back, Ann, and we'll make sure we get you on the line. Dr. McCain, you know, we've talked about relationships, but what we know, and I guess what the statistics show and tell us too, is that not all of these relationships and domestic violence, it doesn't all look the same, right? But one thing that I guess is consistent, you mentioned power and control, and that comes in many different variations, right? And so domestic violence and abuse, it doesn't have to be physical. I know that's what we usually think, but it can be emotional. It can be control over your finances. Can you talk a little bit about the other forms other than what we normally think of someone putting their hands on the other? Dr. McCain? Okay, we may. You still there, Dr. McCain?
Oh, yes. I'm so sorry. I didn't realize that question was directed to me. I thought you were asking Alicia.
Oh, yes. It's for you.
Yeah. You know, the financial, you just brought that up as one of the other forms of abuse when the abuser controls the finances, how money is being spent, checking the checkbook, or giving an allowance, essentially not allowing a person to have financial freedom and independence. Even if that person is the breadwinner, they may go out and make the money, but their partner controls how it's being spent. There's also something I think is very important that we talk about is the digital abuse, which happens more frequently with younger people. You know, they're all attached to their electronics, their pads, their phones, etc. But someone that's constantly checking your email or your phone, any of those mediums that you use to communicate, that's also a form of abuse. There's also religious or spiritual abuse. These are things that people don't think about. But if a partner doesn't allow you to worship the way you wish to, go to church or whatever faith it is that you subscribe to, when they control that or make comments about it, try to prevent you from you know, engaging or participating in a spiritual experience. Those are other things. Of course, we know there's sexual abuse. I would point out that even in a marriage, if you say no or you choose not to have sex with your husband, that is still considered abusive. So again, I think people don't marry that you have a voice or you don't have the agency to decline or to say no. If a partner forces you or demands that you have sex, that is still a form of abuse. Or even doing things sexually that are against your wishes or that you don't enjoy. These are things that abusers will do. And of course, we know the common, the verbal abuse, the threats, the name calling, the belittling. All of these things are indicators that this is not a healthy relationship. And more than likely, it would fit the definition of being domestic or intimate partner abuse.
Alicia, did you have the tools to deal with your abusive relationship? And if you did not, how did you gain them if you did?
I did not have the tools to deal with them when I was in the relationship, but when I pivoted, we both got tools together because we knew we had to co-parent.
And so when you both, and I think this is interesting, that it sounds like your partner was open to sort of investigating why he was an abuser. And did you then stay in that relationship, or you both got help outside of your relationship and that relationship was never resurrected?
Yeah, the relationship never resurrected, but we continued in the relationship because
because of your child. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. So the relationship was definitely severed. Neither of us were our best selves, and we realized that our childhood traumas just didn't mix. That's the way we articulated it. But we knew we wanted a healthy relationship so that we could properly co-parent. Our son was our priority, and we definitely knew with certainty we agreed to that, and that we really truly loved him enough to do whatever we needed to do to make ourselves better so that he could be his best. We got counseling. We got individual counseling as well as we got family counseling. The late Dr. Francis Quest Wrestling was a part of our team to aid and assist us because the generational curse and all of that that happened in my childhood, that trauma, because I was in a domestic violent relationship before I knew that it was such. You know, I grew up in that hustle. So all of that had to come up and come out and really, truly be dealt with, you know. So it was a lot of work, but definitely needed. And that's part of the reason why I am such a strong advocate. And I speak not only to women in art in the situations or coming out of the situations, but I do a lot of preventive measures by having pillow talk conversations with students at Howard University and various other young teens in relationships or when they begin to be in relationships. You know, so it's all about the prevention and really bringing more awareness. And one of the things I did want to make sure I made a point of, with young boys, it's so important to empower them early on to stand up against it and not to tolerate young girls being disrespectful to them. I had to step in when my son was in sixth grade. A young girl had pushed him down and really injured him. She was being intentional about it. She had been picking on him for days. And, of course, when he got in the car, he didn't want to be, quote-unquote, considered a punk. And I said, no, let's properly phrase things right now this day so you'll never be misunderstood. No one, male or female, should touch another person, period, ever. Use your words. And if your words can't help you, then you need to separate. And so I went into the school, and I was very, very upset because a teacher actually witnessed him get abused on that playground and didn't say anything, and then later told him to toughen it up. So we worked that situation completely out. I was like, because if it was vice versa, if it was a young girl that you had pushed down, oh my God, I would have been called before lunch to come up here and get you. You would have been suspended.
Mm-hmm.
The same discipline that would have been afforded my son if he was the one, there's the same discipline that I desire to see for her, because she needs to learn too. We do not touch each other to hurt one another. That is not who we are.
And Dr. McCain, does that put even more pressure on teachers? You know, there's so much that they have to do already, and there's so many issues that they're probably dealing with that are coming from the home into their classroom. But based on what Alicia is saying, and that we kind of know this, it's still, you know, there are still some kind of built-in, maybe stereotypical approaches that we take to dealing with boys and girls. So how do you even, for lack of a better word, fix that when there's so many other issues, you know, in schools that teachers are trying to deal with, and now we're trying to kind of reprogram them in some ways, all of us, on how we deal with issues such as Alicia expressed regarding her young boy with a girl who pushed him down and the teacher's response to it?
Yeah, you're right. You know, teachers have their hands full, but it's certainly, in my opinion, one of the areas where more education is needed. You know, we live in a society that, you know, we're still dealing with cultural norms. And what we're talking about is it used to be understood that, you know, boys are tough and they fight and girls are soft and they, you know, they play with dolls. So a teacher who is still not perhaps aware of the fact that, you know, we have to start very young and recognize this for what it is. Just as Alicia said, if your child is being hit, doesn't matter if it's from a girl or a boy, that warrants attention. So I think the answer to that, it really involves and should include a level of education that teachers are getting. We also go into the schools. We've done some work with guidance counselors, and it's important for them to really understand what this looks like. While, again, they have a lot on their plates, and there are even some that will say that, you know, this is not a subject that should be output or responsibility that teachers should have, but kids spend a lot of time in school. And as you know, you just heard, children are doing things, they're acting out, and parents aren't there to address it. So I do think it's the responsibility of the schools and the teachers to intervene, but they would have to be educated. And we as a society have to really start looking at, you know, the cultural norms, you know, around gender inequality and, you know, teaching boys to not be aggressive in that way and to understand what it is to have healthy, respectful relationships.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tonight, our focus is on domestic violence, surviving it, recognizing it, moving forward from it. Phone lines are open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. McCain, I want to piggyback a little bit about what Alicia was mentioning when she was saying that her and her former partner had a child together. I would think during a pregnancy that women are especially vulnerable in trying to combat abuse if they're in that type of relationship. Can you talk a little bit about that? If that is the case, what women should do? Should they have a birth plan in place? Say maybe if the partner who's been abusive wants to be in the delivery room when the child is about to be born, or even be prior to that, how women should deal with a situation like that. I think I may have the answer, but I'll let you sort of tell me what path you should take.
Well, you know, you bring up another very interesting subject, which is domestic violence and pregnancy. There are some that believe that when a woman, in fact, some women will even get pregnant to prevent the abuse, meaning that when they're in a vulnerable state carrying a male child, that they'll be less inclined to abuse them. But the reality of it is that they're at even greater risk of being abused if it's already occurred when they are carrying a child. So just as we talk about safety plans, it's always important to have a safety plan, one that you know very well, that's rehearsed, and they're individual to the individual that needs it. So, of course, if a woman is pregnant and she is in a situation where she fears or does not want the child's father to be there, then certainly measures need to be put in place beforehand so that her wishes can be granted. But I think the most important thing is to make sure that she's safe.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Alicia, were there any long-term, or have there been long-term effects from your experiences with domestic abuse?
Long-term effects?
Mm-hmm.
No, I think the long-term, no, I don't think that there's been any long-term effects. There's definitely been healing. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity to share our testimony to help other people be edified, be empowered. One of the things within my Sisters in Touch network, I'm constantly saying to other women, when I share my authentic testimony in total transparency in that safe space, I always tell women it's important for us to be a safe place for one another and to create a safe space for one another. Because too often we feel, when we're in a volatile situation, we are shamed. And so we won't be forthcoming within our sister circles, and we won't ask for help because we don't want to be judged and we don't want to be criticized. But if we create a safe place and we are a safe space for women, more and more are inclined to come to us and talk to us, and we can help navigate and sometimes intervene, and the relationship does not have to dissolve if both parties are willing to get help.
Go right ahead, Dr. McCain.
And I would just say that, Alicia, you're fortunate that, you know, that it did not have any long-term effects on you, because we see survivors that are coming in years after the abuse, and they're still experiencing the anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression. It does significantly, and can, I should say, significantly impact one's mental stability, just even down to trust. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you begin to trust in relationships? How do you begin to feel, even just from the standpoint of your own self-worth? There's so much abusers do such a good job of tearing their partners down, their victims down, by belittling them, making them feel worthless. They have no self-esteem. So it really takes a toll, and it's really a difficult process to recover from that. It's a healing process, and it takes time. It can be slow, and it's different for everyone. But the impact and the effects of domestic abuse can be devastating. Of course, perhaps the length of time, the severity of the abuse, again, it's all individual. But I would certainly want it to be understood that many people do suffer and experience severe mental issues. In fact, that's one of the things that we're seeing now after COVID. You know, victims were locked in their homes with their abusers. They couldn't get out. They were fearful, constantly being watched. We have seen a significant increase in requests for mental health services, so much so that we had to hire another therapist because the demand was so high.
Wow.
Well, I do want to just interject to that. I don't want to minimize in any shape, form, or fashion the trauma that I experienced. The relationship was an 8-year marriage, and this has been a 22-year healing journey. Mm-hmm. So it did not happen overnight. And yes, I went to the core of it. And that's why having that conversation with my dad, my first true love, really aided and assisted me in healing and moving forward.
We're going to take a quick time out. An important conversation we're having tonight, domestic violence, surviving it, coping with it, learning from it, moving forward from it, sharing stories to help others. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. The phone lines are still open. We're going to continue this conversation right after this quick break. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment. The phone lines are still open, 202-319-7810. I think Ann has called us back, so we're going to go to Ann with her question or comment. Go right ahead, Ann.
I was a victim of domestic violence some years ago. When I was 32, I'm 49 now. And sometimes it's not even how they treat you. Just you have to listen to your surroundings, how they treat others. He was on the phone one day. He was talking to his grandma. And I was like, who are you talking to? He called her all type of names. I said, who are you talking to? He said, my grandma. I said, he was like, his grandma he was talking to. I should have left then. And after that, and I was supposed to defend myself. But you never know how what the people, with their intentions. He beat me. He beat me unconsciously. He ended up, in the hospital. I had to get surgery. And the DEA was involved. They end up bringing it down to to simple assault because I had moved. They sent the address to the wrong, the mail to the wrong address.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying this to say that sometimes, and then you go in denial, and because I didn't think he would really do this to me, to the point they locked me up because I didn't make it to court. Because I said I turned around, I said that he didn't do it to me. They locked me up. Because I didn't make it. I was saying that maybe he didn't do, they locked me up. And then he ended up not doing nothing but like 2 years in jail. There's something that started off as being as attempted murder to simple assault.
All right. Well, we're so glad that you were able to make it through, Ann. And thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. And Dr. McCann, and again, I'm sure this isn't, these kinds of stories are familiar. And I would think that you may hear, and you tell me if I'm wrong, people who have been abused in relationships may still love these people, may be confused on why they love someone who is hurting them. How does that conversation, how do you get people to kind of digest that maybe that's not really abnormal, that you love them, but you shouldn't be with them? I'm sure there's some conflict with survivors of that may love these people and maybe even blame themselves for loving someone who hurts them.
You're right on point with that, and it's a reality. I would say all victims love their abusers. They did not. You have to remember that they didn't start out being abusive. They started out being very loving, very charming, You know, and as I said before, even if those signs are there, more often than not, victims don't see them. They're more focused on what this person is doing and how they're treating them at that time. So it does make for a very, very difficult situation, and it is very conflicting and very confusing. Unfortunately, as we heard from a few callers, and most don't ever really get it until they find themselves at a place where it has become almost fatal, or they've just had enough.
Mm-hmm.
They've seen it. They realize now that this person is not going to change. And when we talk about this, one of the other reasons why they stay in these situations, because yes, they love them, but they believe that they can change them. They don't believe that the person is really what they see, because they want to go back to the way it was in the beginning. And you also hear about the honeymoon phase. They're abusive. And after the abuse, they do all kinds of, you know, they're sorrowful. They apologize. They promise they'll never do it again. They buy them gifts. They mm-hmm. tell them how much they love them. So, yes, you are in this real crazy state where someone has just done something horrific to you, but then they turn around and tell you they love you. They apologize. They promise they'll never do it again. So what happens? You believe them and you stay. So it's a very, very complex scenario, and one that without counseling, and as we heard, Alicia has had work, it takes a lot of work to really come to terms with what you're faced with. Victims are oftentimes in denial. They normalize the behavior. They minimize what's happened to them. They blame themselves, and they make excuses for their abusers. So it's, like I said, it's a very challenging dynamic, and one that oftentimes warrants counseling.
Alicia, you had mentioned earlier that you work with some Howard University students, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What kind of feedback do you get from them? Is it all sort of passive, they're taking it in, or do they exchange some of their stories or the questions they ask? What has that been like for you, and what is it that they share or say to you, if you can share that with us?
Yes, we're keeping our, you know, non-disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything is personal and confidential in our safe space when we do host Pillow Talks. I've been mentoring, I called them my baby bison, since 2005. It was my own personal outreach, because as an alum at Howard University, I had amazing mentors when I was there. So when I relocated back to the area in 2005, I gave back what was given to me. In doing so, when we do have our Pillow Talks and our transparent conversations, you'd be amazed at how many of them, just by me being transparent about growing up in a domestic violence household,
mm-hmm.
they begin to like say, okay, I need to pay closer attention to the way that in which I involve myself in relationships. So it's a precursor, you know, it's a preventive measure for them, just having that bit of information to say, hey, if I grew up in that type of household, I may be more inclined to accept and tolerate things in relationships that will not yield itself to be in a healthy relationship. And then some of them get really, really quiet when I talk about how I met my ex-husband. Well, we were students at Howard University, some of the red flags in the initial relationship before we even got married,
mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. So they get quiet, and I'm skilled in this thing now, so I kind of know the ones that I need to do a 101 lunch with to follow it up and really, really get to the core of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's what it is, but I'm really blessed to have had the opportunity to share my testimony so transparently. And I say we're overcome by the power of our testimony, because it not only empowered me to really become a greater advocate and really feel confident in any space of sharing, but it also has empowered so many of my mentees to join me in this space of advocacy and be willing when I say, oh, hey, I'm hosting Pillow Talk, who's coming up on campus and sharing? I don't always have to tell my story. They're willing to tell theirs now too.
And Dr. McCain, in our last few minutes, we mentioned this with men, do you get calls at the Family Justice Center from men? Do men come in? Do they share their experiences with you at the center?
Yes, they do. And as I pointed out, we are seeing an increase in the number of men that are coming forward for help.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult for them. They're embarrassed. They're shameful. They're very prideful. It's not what is expected of a man. So yes, they do. One of the reasons why I think we've also seen an influx of men is because we're now offering services in what we call a hybrid model, whereby we're doing intakes either virtually or over the phone, so they don't have to physically walk into the building,
mm-hmm.
which makes it a little easier for them to reach out and ask for help. But most certainly men are definitely being victimized, and I'm grateful for the fact that they are also stepping up and asking for help.
Well, we are grateful for all that you do, Dr. McCain and Alicia Walker, for what you are doing, especially with students, opening up that conversation that probably many never have. And as you said, may not feel a safe space to be able to do that, but you're offering it. So, Alicia Walker, we thank you for being with us, domestic violence advocate and survivor, and Dr. Denise McCain, director of the Family Justice Center at Prince George's County. Thank you so much for being with us, you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's the Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141 for this Thursday, October 27th. I'm Bramonte Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. Have a great night.